Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Dear Prudence.
Do you think that I should contact him again?
Help.
Thanks. Thank you.
Welcome back to the Dear Prudence podcast. I am Mallory Ortberg, also known as Dear Prudence, and with us in the studio this week is Carvell Wallace, a writer whose work has appeared at MTV, The New Yorker, and The New York Times, and who most recently wrote a long-form history of the Negro Motorist Green Book. Carvell, welcome to the studio.
Thanks for having me.
I am really glad that you're here for the opening of this episode, actually, because I wanted to start by talking about the greatest letter I have yet received in the Dear Prudence canon, which is the woman whose boyfriend has a tattoo on his back that is either a rosary or a pearl necklace with a bead commemorating every woman he has either dated or slept with.
That's nice.
And he has, I believe he's up to 42, and he recently, as a surprise, gifted her with an addition of four beads.
Why? So she got four because...
She got four. We're not clear.
Okay.
It seems to be maybe a rating system, like four, I don't know, four stars or a five star.
I see.
Is his scale.
Yeah.
But it was clearly like, you're four times better than those other gals.
Than the one pearl or one bead lady.
It's again. And I don't know how he like marks those. I don't know how she knows which four are hers.
Okay. And these people are in a relationship. Like they are dating. They've been an item.
I think they'd been together for a while.
Okay.
And it was just really wonderful because this was like a brand new letter. I've never had a question that was quite like this. I've had questions about weird boyfriends and bad tattoos. But this was really. This was brand new. This was a new problem.
And he sprang it on her like, hey, surprise,
yes.
I got you some beads to represent your level of accomplishment.
And it sounds like up until this moment, she had thought that the tattoo was just like a religious tattoo.
Just like a general rosary.
He's Catholic. He's like, got a rosary.
Like a non-sex related.
No.
A non-doing it rating system.
I get a new one every time I have a new sexual partner. And baby, you're the latest.
Well, I hope she feels flattered because this is a wonderful thing this man has done to memorialize.
All I can think of
his caring and love for her.
All I can think of is the Count of Monte Cristo, like marking the days in his cell, you know, with Roman numerals.
There is something prison-like about the whole arrangement, but it almost makes it feel like that. You know, for him, each person he sleeps with is some kind of like it's like his last chance for something.
It definitely feels like something big's going to happen emotionally when he runs out of room on his back.
I think the question, maybe that's when he'll get married. See, you're always taking it to the dark place. Maybe he's building up to a lifelong commitment. But the thing I wonder about most is like, so she's got four, right? Like he added four beads and said, baby, this, you're a four
no
bead
one's
lady.
Gotten four before.
Oh, so it's like, so she set a record.
It would seem, but it also seems like he sort of switched it up. It used to just be like one per person, and now it's turned into a rating system.
I see.
And it seems like a little arbitrary, sort of like you get four.
Well, the statistician in me does not like that at all because, as we know from Major League Baseball, if you don't count records the same way over time, then how can you compare a player from one era to a player from another era?
So he's like the Pete Rose of sex tattoos.
In some ways, he is, because he violates the game.
I feel really good about knowing that.
That's your one sports reference for, like, I think the millennia?
I get that, and also everything from the Homer at the Bat episode of The Simpsons.
Right. All Simpsons sports-related things aside, that's pretty good.
That's about all I have.
Yeah.
But I think the other thing about it that was just so amazing is he has this, like, very personal sexual history tattooed on a part of his body that
he can't
see.
It's okay to get choked up. This is an emotional thing. This is a beautiful thing. I understand why.
He can't see his own sexual scorecard.
Right.
he has to take other people's word for it, that it's there.
Yeah, well, it's because he's put all that stuff behind him, you see.
Oh!
Hey!
Hey!
Where's
okay.
Where's the rim shot?
That's...
You don't have that?
I just... Thank you. Thank you for that. No, but I loved that question. It was wonderful. If anyone who is listening has a better ex with a really strange or ill-advised tattoo story, please let me know. Please send pictures.
Yeah.
Prudence@slate.com. I would like to get more questions about tattoo-initiated arguments, actually.
Yeah.
Let's have more of those in the studio.
Okay. We will.
Great. Have you ever gotten in a fight with someone about a tattoo or the idea of a tattoo?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I got a tattoo of my mother's name on my arm, and it was not under the best of circumstances. It was right after she died, and I was really depressed, and I looked up her name in Google Images one morning.
Oh, wow.
And the image that came up was like the logo for this stationery card company that has the same name she did. And I just went and got that tattooed on my arm. So no one fought with me about that because I think everyone was just like, no one's gonna come at you directly about that.
Right.
But I think there was conflict implied.
Do you wish that someone had tried to hold you back?
You know, the irony of it is that it's actually a really beautiful tattoo. And it turns out that this company changes their logo on a semi-regular basis. So when I went back to look at the tattoo, like the Google image after I got the tattoo done, mm-hmm. it was totally different. It was like in ransom letters. And so if my mother had died like a week later, I would have had her name tattooed on my arm.
I never thought I would say this, but I'm really glad your mom died when she did.
Yeah. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Things have a way of working out. But the tattoo, it ended up being beautiful. It was a beautiful logo, and I'm happy I got it.
It looks nice. I've seen it.
Yeah. It was not under the best of circumstances, but
yeah, no,
much of life is not.
It's not a heart with the word mom written over it, which I think could have been a real step down.
Right.
Have you ever gotten a fight with someone else over a tattoo that they got?
I'm going to have to dig in the crates to like remember that. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've ever, I try not to take people's tattoos personally. You know what I'm saying?
Well, we're just not going to get along.
Have you?
I take every tattoo
for...
I see personally.
Okay.
I see tattoos on strangers and I take it personal.
Can you tell me about a situation in which you have had a fight with someone about?
I have a lot of fights in my head with people about their tattoos. It is hard, but especially once someone's gotten one.
Right.
You can't. What can you? All you can do is make them feel bad about something they can't really change.
It's a little bit like when someone has a baby and they name it something god awful. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And you're like, you can't say
anything.
You can't
unring that bell.
Can't unring that bell.
Yeah.
You can't put that toothpaste back in the tube.
Yeah. And I think most people, when they're asking for advice on a tattoo, have already made up their minds. And what they're really looking for is for you to betray the fact that you don't like their idea.
Right.
And then when they get it, they can say, well, now do you like it?
That's right.
And you have to say, oh, yeah.
That's right.
Oh, you know, when I was picturing it, I thought you meant.
That's right.
Something
that's
worse, right. But this is, I like this.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I've seen some terrible tattoos.
Yeah.
They happen.
Yeah, but I'm glad that you're able to let that go. Okay, before we get started by talking about the letters from this week, I want to make one announcement about a new policy. Which is, there's a certain type of letter that comes in a lot, especially to the Dear Prudence inbox, that has to do with wedding etiquette. Which is already, I might not be the best person to ask about that because there are kind of classic areas of wedding etiquette that I don't really agree with the sort of received wisdom. But especially there's a certain type of question about wedding etiquette, which isn't, should I do the thing I'm considering? Or, you know, is it okay for me to decline this invitation because something happened that really upsets me? But it's just asking for a ruling. Usually about how the couple that's getting married has arranged their registry or the way in which they're asking for gifts or money. And what the writer always wants to know is just, don't you think that's tacky?
Right. So people come to you for like a judgment.
Yes.
Like you're like it's the people's court.
They just want a stranger to say, that is tacky.
Right.
You should feel quietly superior to those people.
Right.
And I that's not a very interesting question. And I also like it's the question I got most recently was this couple asked for, they had like a crowdfunding set up so that we could help pay for their honeymoon if we wanted. And the letter writer said, I actually always give money at weddings, but I still don't like this. Don't you think it's tacky? And I think it's really weird the way the word tacky gets used about other people's weddings.
Yes.
And I'm not quite sure what it is that bothers me, but it feels like that's really has a lot to do with class in a way that feels uncomfortable. And like, I think you can always get more specific. If what you mean is like rude or presumptuous, say that. If what you mean is just, I don't like it.
Right. It's not the way I would do it.
Yeah. Which is the question is like, don't you think I should like disapprove of them? Like, I guess,
that's
man.
Right.
But like, you already went to the wedding. You weren't asking if you shouldn't go.
Right.
You're not apparently not close enough to them to say like, hey, I actually think it's rude of you to ask your guests for money for your honeymoon, which I don't know why a KitchenAid isn't rude. But a honeymoon is.
Right.
That feels a little arbitrary to me.
Well, I think that is the thing that you're getting at with this whole notion of whether or not stuff is tacky, because like these weird like class markers of what's appropriate and not etiquette wise are completely freaking arbitrary.
Right.
And they're arbitrary specifically for the reason that if you don't know them, it just means that you didn't grow up in the right way.
You should know.
Like none of them has any real value. Like why it's okay to give someone a mixer and not okay to give someone like an envelope filled with cash.
Sure.
Makes no difference. Like they're the same thing literally, but by knowing that the mixer is okay and the envelope isn't, you're proving that you have this, that you come from this like background.
Right.
And by not knowing that, you're proving that you don't belong.
Right.
And that's what weddings are about. They're about belonging.
Yes.
And they're about you joining of families and ideas, and people are like, I don't know if I accept this person is now coming into our fold. We have our way of doing things, and like if you do something weird, that means maybe you don't belong here.
Yeah. And I think that you've hit on why those questions bother me, because it sort of feels like, I mean, honeymoons are expensive.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people would rather go on a trip with someone they love than get a stand mixer that's like $300 for something that is essentially a whisk.
Well,
like a whisk plus a really strong arm that doesn't get tired.
Stand mixers are badass.
They always leave a ring that they can't get to. I prefer, what's the kind of mixer that you use with your hand? Like the beaters are still electric, but you can move it around.
A hand mixer?
Yeah, that's the one.
But that's, I mean, all due respect.
No, it's like $40.
All
probably.
Due respect.
I can't remember the last time I bought one.
All due respect. I don't know that you've done enough baking to fully appreciate.
Wow.
Yeah, that's right.
Wow, okay.
We just went there.
Okay.
To fully appreciate the
area
massive
woman
difference.
Bakes insufficiently.
This is true. I mean, you're baking a cake, some brownies, sure, a hand mixer's fine. But once you start getting into, like, all the different kinds of folds that you have to do to get, like, different batters to set up in different ways and be aerated on different levels.
I don't like where this conversation is going, because I feel like I went from being right to not being so right.
That's, yeah.
And I would like to stop.
Conversely, I enjoy this conversation, so that just goes to show.
Well, the point is, I don't bake that much, and you shouldn't write to me if you just want me to confirm that someone did something tacky at their wedding, especially if you already went, it's too late to do anything about it.
Especially because that's not really an advice question.
It isn't
what should I do, it's just like, don't you agree with the way I feel?
Right, and I'm not Miss Manners.
Right.
And even Miss Manners, I feel like, is pretty relaxed about deciding that other people are or aren't tacky. Like, she'd rather get a question about what you should do rather than how you should feel.
Because regulating people's feelings is actually bad manners.
I'm upset by how good you are at this and the fact that you bake more than me.
I will dial it back.
I appreciate that. On that note, Carvel's going to help me answer a couple of questions today, and a lot of them are pretty intense. So let's jump right into it.
Let's jump right in. Sleeves rolled up here.
Yeah. So the first one is called loss of child.
Oh, wow.
It's slightly more metaphorical than you think. So I guess don't worry so much. Dear Prudence, I adopted a very troubled foster child when she was 6 years old. She had a myriad of problems, including reactive attachment disorder and oppositional defiant disorder. I got her into a special needs school and took her to 3 to 5 therapy sessions every week for 12 years. She hated living with me and longed to go back to her birth parents. She ran away 8 times. When she was 18, she moved back in with her birth parents, and I grieved her loss for 3 years. Now that I finally feel resolved with that part of my life, she's begun calling me and telling me that her birth parents have rejected her, and now she wants money and help. My family says to ignore her and that she is only using me. I'm afraid to open myself up to that pain again. What do you think?
Wow. Oh, man. Yeah, I mean, you know, this question actually hits home for me, because this is not totally unlike my own childhood in that I was taken in by a family that wasn't my birth family when I was eight. And then I returned to live with my mother when I was, they were like extended relatives. And then I returned to live with my mother when I was like 13. And actually that same thing happened when I was 18 months too. I went to live with another set of relatives and then returned to my mother at four. So I know how like crazy it can be when you change families a lot, and like reactive attachment disorder is a phrase I didn't know until someone told me. But when I heard about it, I was like, oh, that's exactly how I felt.
Yeah. What is that, by the way? I haven't heard that before.
Well, I'm not qualified to like really put it into super duper like legit words.
Okay.
So I could just be spouting weird stuff. But the way I understand it is that it has to do with like we form like our what's happening in early childhood, like infancy and our early like bonding with our using maternal figures, is that we're learning how to build reaction, like how to build attachments and how to connect and expect things from people and want things from people and know how to show up and have people show up for us. And all that's happening really early, like in the first like 3-4 months, you know. And when kids have that disrupted, then they react and don't react to attachment in weird ways.
Right.
They bond to people they shouldn't bond to. They let go of people at like random moments. They're able to shut down their like emotions. It's a whole bunch of, and that leads to a whole bunch of other weird stuff. So like a teacher might find that they build a relationship with that kid and it seems super cool. And then halfway through the year, that kid just does something really terrible. That like, and the teacher's like, what was that? I thought we were cool.
Yeah.
And that person just was hurtful to me. But that's a kid who's like struggling with how to properly build and maintain relationships.
Right. I think too, one thing that leapt out at me in the way that this letter was written is it's incredibly emotionally constricted. Like the letter writer, and I don't want to ascribe anything about the letter writer's like emotional makeup from that, but just like it's just she had a lot of problems. I took her to many therapy sessions. She hated living with me and ran away. There was nothing of I really loved her. I was really sad that I couldn't, you know, help her open up in the way I wanted. I tried to give her a lot of love. And again, that doesn't mean that those things didn't happen. I just that really stands out to me that this letter feels like it was written by someone who is trying to put all of their feelings in like a 2x4 box.
Yeah. That's interesting. I mean, and I think when you take on, I mean, raising children is super duper hard. And I think when you take on a child at a certain age and you kind of bring them into your life, and they already have a set of issues that you didn't quite create, that can be really hard. And I think parents react to that in different ways. Some parents are just like, I'm going to leave my heart open and blah, blah, blah. But sometimes kids are, those kids are really difficult and parents feel double-crossed and double-crossed again and again. And sometimes the response to that is to sort of be like, I have to maintain what appear to be some boundaries of coldness, but are really boundaries of like me just like not getting swept up in this person's tornado. That having been said, I think that when you take a kid in at that age, you're making a commitment.
Yeah.
And that's what you've signed up for.
Yep.
One time my own daughter, who I did not adopt, I was complaining. I think I've told you this before. They were in the car and they were loud. I had two kids. They were, at that point, this was like 3 years ago, so they were 7 and, you know, 10 or something. And they were so loud and it was so annoying. And finally I was like, guys, can you just, with the noise, can you knock it off? And my daughter goes, if you didn't want it to be loud, don't have kids. And it was one of those moments where I was like, actually, she's right. And I've kind of held that as a little bit of a credo. Like, I did sign up for this. And I think that, and that doesn't mean that you're happy about everything. It doesn't mean that you love everything. It doesn't mean you let whatever happens. But it means that that's part of the commitment that you make when you invite a child. Because I don't think there's anything crueler than, especially for someone that's already experienced a break in that attachment, to say, like, I'm here for you. I love you. I support you. And if my love is unconditional. And then now you're acting in a way I don't like. Never mind.
Right. And I think that can sometimes come up, with things like adoption and fostering kids. Like, there was the sort of famous story a few years back of a woman who had adopted a young boy from Russia, and he came to her, I think, around 7 or 8 years of age, and a year later she sent him back on a plane with a note pinned to him.
Jesus.
Just like, I can't raise him.
Wow.
And not to compare the letter writer to that situation, but I think sometimes, especially in America, there's a narrative about adoption that's a little bit like, you're doing someone a favor.
Yes.
They should be grateful.
Yes.
And if they don't deserve your love and affection, you should cut them off, that comes a little quicker than it does with biological children. Like, I'm trying to read this. I think if I read this and it was not, I adopted a troubled foster child, but it was just, my daughter's very troubled. She has a lot of issues. She ran away when she was 18. Like, she moved out and now she's in touch with me again. I think there'd be slightly less of, everyone in my life says she's just using you, don't talk to her.
Yes. Like, this, people don't say that your children are just using you as quickly as they say that about adopted children.
Right, right. And again, I don't want to, there's very little to go on in this letter. I don't want to suggest the letter writer is, like, responsible for this narrative or is a bad person. But I think this person, this girl's your daughter. Like, full
right.
stop.
Not adopted daughter,
she's
but daughter.
She's your daughter. That's even right. though she ran away to live with her birth parents. Like. Right. You know, the 3 to 5 therapy sessions you drove her to every week for 12 years aren't something she owes you for.
Right.
That was something that you did that made you her parent.
Right.
And so I think, don't think of that as like, so she fucking owes me
right.
gratitude and good behavior. Think of that as, I did that for my kid. And she might never be the like healthy, well-adjusted adult I would love for her to be. But I didn't do that as a favor to someone else's kid to get them to become mine.
Yeah. One of the other things that struck me about the way this letter is constructed, and this is more the writer in me that sort of like reads about how, you know, reads through the lines about how people organize their arguments, is that, you know, I'm assuming it's a she. I don't know, actually. But
right.
it occurs to me that like this thing about her going back to her birth parents mm-hmm. probably felt like something of a betrayal.
Right.
Because just simply because of where it appears in the narrative. Like,
yeah.
I sort of did all this stuff and then she went and did this thing and people are now saying she's using me, as though the fact that she went to find her birth parents is evidence
right.
that this other quote unquote non-birth parent is simply a pawn in this young woman's
right.
game.
Right, right.
And so I can empathize with a feeling of betrayal at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Because one thing I also noticed in my own experience is how the parent that takes over for the parent that has failed
mm-hmm.
usually has terrible opinions of the parent that has failed.
Yeah.
And so I know that, you know, that's something that comes up where a parent is like, you know, like they don't trust the mother or whomever that has left and they don't think you should either.
Right.
And so if you develop your own point of view about right. that parent that abandoned you, that's really hurtful to the parent that took you in.
And it must somehow be a moratorium on the way that I tried to raise you.
That's right. You're rejecting my thing altogether.
Right, right. Yeah. So I would try to urge this letter writer, I think, not to think of her getting to be with her birth parents as a rejection of you.
Absolutely.
It's actually pretty understandable that she would want to have, if possible, some sort of relationship with them. And it's actually very sad that her birth parents have yet again turned her out.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
And again, that doesn't make her an easy person to get along with. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you guys are going to be able to have some sort of like flawless parent-child relationship. But like, this is a young person in a lot of pain.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean you have to give her money. I don't know what she's like with money. There's nothing in here about what she wants the money for. Like, is this money for food and rent, or is this just money because she'd like to squeeze something out of you? Like, you'll have to kind of think about that as you decide whether or not you do want to help her financially. If she just, it says money and help, like,
yeah.
I think you should consider very seriously taking that call.
Yeah.
And even if it's painful.
I would agree.
Yeah.
Because I mean, I think the main thing here is this feeling that like, once you adopt someone, you no longer have adopted them.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're now your child.
Yeah. And that doesn't mean that you have to be a doormat and let her dictate the terms of your relationship forever. You can absolutely set limits. Like, if she becomes like verbally abusive or
yeah.
tries to harm you in some way, like
right.
absolutely draw a boundary. But if you are just so upset that she went to be with her birth parents that you would like to reject her in turn,
right?
You're the parent. You have to be bigger than that.
Yeah.
And she's your kid. She's always going to be your kid.
Yeah.
And so, unfortunately, you're going to have to be a parent.
Mm-hmm.
I wish them a lot of luck. That sounds really hard.
Yeah, that is a hard situation.
Well, would you like to move on to a letter called "The Worst Aunt in the World"?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. we're on a roll.
I'm going to take a break for a moment to remind you all that the complete Dear Prudence podcast experience is exclusive to Slate Plus members. Members get much more of this show, more questions, more answers, more talking, more advice, with no ads or interruptions. They also get more of the Dear Prudence column on Slate.com. And that's not all. Slate Plus members get longer ad-free versions of other Slate podcasts, too. They get access to the ambitious Slate Academy series, like The History of American Slavery, and A Year of Great Books. They're first in line for tickets to Slate events like live podcast tapings, and they get 30% off tickets. That's not even all. They're tall, strong, and never have cavities. And the whole thing is just $5 a month or $50 for a year. Try it free for 2 weeks. Go to slate.com/prudypod to sign up. All right, so worst aunt in the world.
Aunt or aunt? Go ahead. Moving on.
I say aunt personally.
Yeah,
I feel like for a podcast, I should say aunt.
Is that so? Fascinating.
I feel like it's more formal, and I'm also worried that people would think I meant the bug.
Okay. Then yeah, this is the worst aunt I've ever seen. Go ahead.
All right. So, Dear Prudence, my nephew suffers from a rare disease, and my sister-in-law has found a doctor in Europe who has successfully treated a number of patients with the same illness. She wants to take her son there for treatment, except the costs are very expensive. As the odds of survival remain low, her insurance doesn't cover it. She's raised as much money as she can from family and various fundraisers, but it's not nearly enough. She approached me last week in tears, pleading for financial assistance. I have a large amount of savings in the bank, which I've been saving since I was 12. My fiancé and I were planning to buy a home this year. My sister-in-law is asking to borrow all of it. And realistically, she can't repay me unless she wins the lottery someday. I worked two jobs ever since college and have sacrificed a lot thinking of my own future. Giving all my money now would mean a huge financial setback and long-term repercussions for me. But how can I say no when this means that otherwise my nephew will die before the next New Year? Please help. I'm torn.
Wow. So one time I went to ask a friend of mine for advice on something, and I was like, it was like a moral dilemma, like, should I or should I not do this? And he said to me, the fact that you're asking means that you already know what the right thing is to do. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you wouldn't have to, right? You wouldn't be asking, you're asking for my permission to do the wrong thing,
right?
But you know what the right thing is.
Right.
And that sort of comes to mind when I hear this, because it makes me think about why this person has written this letter. Like, why, like, if they want to, like, they know the right thing to do is to help in the situation,
mm-hmm.
but they don't want to have to.
Yeah.
And they're asking if it's okay to not.
Yeah.
And so really it's not a question of, like, what is the right or wrong,
right? You know that,
versus what is acceptable. Mm-hmm. Is it, like, personally, spiritually, morally, publicly acceptable to deny this money? And the situation is so dire because it's really like your money or your life.
Yeah,
it's like this thing standing between me and the death of this relative.
Right,
is this amount of money that I've saved,
and more than the death of this boy, because it sounds like, you know, this isn't a sure thing. This isn't like, this treatment is almost guaranteed to cure him. But it would be the difference between a death where it felt like they were able to do everything they could to try to save a very young person from dying, you know, an untimely death, versus we did all we could. Sometimes in life, you face an illness that no amount of money or treatment can cure. I mean, if like, I guess the way I would think of it is, like, if you gave the money,
yes,
and he died anyways,
yeah,
to me, the gift you would be giving his mother is the knowledge that she didn't let her son die when there was a chance someone could have helped him. And I feel so strongly that that would be worth it.
Well, the flip side of that too, which leads to the same conclusion, is this is one of the ones we have to play the tape forward and be like, if I don't give the money,
mm-hmm.
and this person dies,
mm-hmm.
how am I going to feel in 10 years, 15 years, 20 years?
Yeah.
Like, to what extent is that going to, like, trouble me.
Yeah, in my beautiful house that I get to buy with the money I've been saving since I was 12.
That someone was like, and I don't, and it's interesting because usually in letters like this, it seems like people offer some mitigating stuff.
Right.
Like, I know this is the right thing to do, but my sister-in-law is always running these scams.
I hate her. Or she has a history of lying about illness.
But there's none of that here. Mm-hmm. And so this really feels like, it's not like the sister-in-law is like, always coming to borrow money. It's not one of those weird moral things you get sometimes where it's like, this person's always struggling with money. I shouldn't have to help them.
Right.
And it's just like, here's the situation. I have this money and I don't want to let it go because it could have repercussions for me if I let it go. And I'm like, but if you don't let it go, it'll have pretty severe repercussions maybe for you also, and definitely for people that, again, based on the letter, I'm assuming are family members that you are currently in good and loving standing with.
Yeah. And honestly, even if you only sort of like them, you know, you're brother's child, that's a close relationship. And that's a young, you know what I mean? It's not like, well, he's already in his 70s. Maybe it's time. This is a child.
Yeah.
And I feel like reading this, I feel like this letter writer has their heart in the right place.
Yeah.
I think they know what they have to do.
Yeah.
I think their real question is, why is life so unfair?
Mm.
And not just why was it unfair to my brother and his wife and their child, but why do I have to suffer? Like, as a result, why can't they get the money some other way?
Yeah.
And that just sucks. I'm really sorry. Like,
yeah.
You've worked really hard and you really had your heart set on something that's important, but not more important than a sick kid. And it's got to hurt and feel unfair to think all the things that I've spent my time thinking about and working towards all of a sudden are totally trumped by
some random thing that I didn't even, like, have anything to do with.
Right.
Just got foisted on me. You know, I keep replaying this letter in my head and trying to find what is the logistical reason why you'd be reluctant. I mean, I understand you don't want to give up your life savings, but I keep being like, is the sister-in-law, do they have a bad relationship or something like that? And the other question that I keep wondering is, why didn't the brother come and ask?
Yeah, because it says my sister-in-law.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the brother's not even mentioned. So I don't, that to me is a random, it's a thread you can't follow because you would just be guessing.
Too many unknowns.
But the only way that you could really, I think you could really morally justify balking at this proposition is if there were some tremendous and specific damage. And I don't even know what that would be.
Right.
That would like trump the life of a child.
The only thing that I can think of right now, weirdly, I don't often get biblical on the show.
Oh, here we go.
But it reminds me of the Book of Esther, which is from the Hebrew Old Testament, if you're playing as a Protestant. And the basic story is that Esther is a young Jewish woman who kind of through a series of outrageous events becomes the wife of the king of this great kingdom. And he doesn't know that she's Jewish and kind of like in the background, one of his advisors is sort of plotting to carry out like a pogrom against all the Jews in the kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And her cousin is this beggar. He sits outside the city gates. His name is Mordecai. And she calls to him one evening and she kind of says, you know, the king doesn't know that I'm Jewish. If I go to him and kind of ask him to protect us as a people, I'm sort of afraid that he won't help me or that he'll think less of me or that I'll get in trouble. I'm afraid to do something that I know is the morally right thing to do. Mm. And Mordecai says to her, you know, here's the thing. If you remain silent, help might come from another corner and you'll have to live with that. And who knows that whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Like he kind of reframes it as maybe this is why you're here.
Maybe this is why you saved the money.
Right. Like, yeah, maybe this is why you saved the money.
Yeah.
So that you could be a part of something that would either save a child or at the very least give his parents a peace of mind of knowing that they did everything they could to save his life.
Yeah. And there's also the old, if the situation were reversed.
I just think it's going to be something that, like, it's going to be unfair and shitty in parts, and you're going to be able to sleep really well.
Mm.
And that's an important part of being a person, I think, is making decisions that don't, like, a year or 5 years or 10 years from now wake you up in the middle of the night and make you think, oh, my God, how did I miss that? And I don't think you're going to feel that way if you give them the money.
Mm-hmm.
I think, yeah, mm-hmm. give them the money. Give them the money and let us know how things go.
We will give them the money.
Ding, yep. Ding. Okay. So the nice thing is we're like slowly moving in a gentler direction. These letters very slowly get less and less sort of earth shattering.
Good, because I don't know how much deeper.
Yeah.
Dear
yeah.
Prudence, my hand was chopped
they
off.
They do.
By a baby.
They do. My baby.
My baby has chopped my hand off.
They do continue in a sort of financial vein, and these are all sort of like how do I mix relationships and money, family, romantic, etc.
You don't. Moving on.
You don't. Yeah. Yeah. I think there's always like some people who want the answer to be, can I just live in a cave and make financial decisions in a vacuum and never be affected by other people's decisions? And I would love to be able to help more of you do that, but I don't think that's going to be possible. Carvel, thank you very much for joining
really
us in the studio. We'll have to have you back sometime.
Absolutely.
I want to close all of these wonderful financially related letters by looking at what happens when you turn a relationship into a financial transaction. When you sort of buy into the idea that the party that makes more money should have more say in your relationship and that the person who makes less money doesn't get to contribute in the same way to household decisions. That is how you end up as the second Mrs. De Winter in Daphne du Maurier's Rebecca, where she wanders through the halls of Manderley, too afraid to ask if she can have her tea in her room instead of the library, which is drafty and full of the creepy old Mrs. Danvers, reminding her of how great the first Mrs. De Winter was, who had her own money and, as such, could say bo to a goose. That's what happens. You end up being Joan Fontaine, wandering around, getting yelled at by Laurence Olivier, and he says things like, didn't you know I hated Rebecca? And it's like, of course she didn't know you hated Rebecca. You never once said you hated Rebecca. You don't let her ask questions. Creepy guys show up at the house and intimidate the hell out of her. You never smile at her. And you ruin parties by failing to mention things like, by the way, don't ever wear the beautiful dress in the portrait adorning the hall in like the main entryway because I hated my first wife. So she does all this to please you and shows up wearing that dress and you throw a fit. And that's because they had a transactional relationship where she felt like she couldn't say anything because he, quote unquote, saved her from financial ruin because she was just a sad little lady's companion. And he's rich old Dr. Manderley. I cannot remember his given name right now. Maxim. It was Maxim. I remember because Joan Fontaine was always sort of like nervously saying things like, aren't we happy, Maxim? And they weren't. They never were. And it was sad. And then their house burned down. So if you let money add weight to your opinion in a relationship, your house will burn down and you will never be happy. And that's all the advice I have for you today. Thanks for listening to Dear Prudence. Our producer is Casey Miner. Our theme music was composed by Robin Hilton. Steve Lickteig is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts, and Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of Panoply. If you like the show, please go to iTunes and write us a review. iTunes is an opaque overlord, but we do know that reviews help new listeners find the podcast. Plus, we'd like to know what you think. Just search for Slate Dear Prudence. If you want us to answer your question, call and leave us a message at 401-371-DEAR. That's 401-371-3327. And we might give you an answer on an episode of the show. You don't have to use your real name or location. And at your request, we can even alter the sound of your voice. If you want, you can also record your question using the Voice Memo app or its equivalent on your smartphone. When you record your questions, please keep it short, 30 seconds or a minute tops. Send it to us at prudencepodcast@gmail.com. I guess my question is, how does she know that those four belong to her? Like, do they have her name written on? Are they, like, color-coded?
Well,
how's he going to remember that those four belong to her?
That's what I was concerned about, is, like, how does he remember, unless he color-codes them, which would actually be the smart way to go
about
that.
Or, hang on, has a little tiny portrait painted on the inside of each pearl, of each gal.
I feel like that's super labor intensive if you are, like, you know what I mean?
Labor of love. I mean, if he cares enough to get a tattoo of 42 rosary bead / pearls on his back, I think he can go the extra mile and get little tiny, you know, like when they paint your, when they like write your name in rice.
Yeah, okay, but that guy's a specialist. I don't know that you're running the
I really hope we're recording all of this.